So last week, if you guys were with us, we finished John chapter 5. John chapter 5 from verse 16 to the end is one of the most theologically rich sections of Scripture that we have. This particular passage of Scripture that we're about to read, I'm going to take the theological points out of it. So it is going to be another theological kind of study that we're going to be doing tonight. And I'll explain why as we get into it. But let's just start reading. So John chapter 6, verse 1. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Then a great multitude followed him, because they saw his signs which he performed on those who were diseased. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Then Jesus lifted his eyes up, seeing a great multitude coming toward him. He said, Philip, where shall we buy bread that these may eat? This he said to test him, for he himself knew that what he would do. Philip answered, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have just a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, There is a lad here that has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. But what are they among so many? Then Jesus said, Make the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place. So the men sat down in number about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise the fish as much as they wanted. So when they were filled, he said to the disciples, Gather up the fragments that remain, so that nothing is lost. Therefore, they gathered them up and filled the 12 baskets, and the fragments of the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. Then those men who had seen the sign that Jesus did said, This is truly the prophet who has come into the world. So I'm not really going to touch on this section tonight at all. And the reason is because John, every single gospel tells this story. Anyone who's been in the church for any length of time knows this story. It's the feeding of the 5,000. It's in every single gospel. What John does, which is unique, is he explains why Jesus did this miracle. For those of you guys who are keeping count at home, this is his 4th miracle that John has recorded. John only records 7 miracles. So John is not really focusing on all the miracles that Jesus did, like the other gospels. He's focusing on 7 specific ones, and he's giving detailed explanations as to why Jesus did what he did. So this is an important miracle. It's the 4th miracle that he did. And so he devotes quite a few verses as to why Jesus did this particular miracle. But we're not going to get into it tonight. We're going to get into it tomorrow. I mean, next week. Verse 15. Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. So this kind of shows, once again, the Jewish expectation of the Messiah was that he was going to be a conquering king. In fact, historically, we know that there was a couple candidates for Messiah that were contemporaries of Jesus, people who were at the same time as Jesus, who were claiming to be the Christ, the Messiah. And all these people presented themselves as revolutionaries. They all tried to rebel against Rome, and they all tried to overthrow Rome. So when Jesus did this phenomenal miracle, everyone's like, this is the guy. Man, we don't even have to worry about supplies, man. This dude can feed us. Man, our army is going to be well fed. This is going to be awesome. They're like, let's take over Rome right now, man. And so he sensed that they were going to do that to him. So he departs. He goes on to the mountain to be alone and to pray, because that's not why he came to this earth. He didn't come to be a king. He came to be the suffering servant to deliver us from our sins. So he departs, and he lets his disciples leave without him. This is verse 16. Now when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was already dark, and Jesus had not come to them. Then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. So when they rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat, and they were afraid. Now this is a cool section. Like I said, all the other Gospels talk about this story. And in the other Gospels, Mark actually gives us a little bit of illumination that when the disciples were rowing, which, I don't know, how many of you guys have done like the row machine at the gym? Whew, that's a workout, you know, or actually rowed, probably none of us, right? Because we live in Tucson. But, you know, like it's a workout, man. It works out your back, your legs, it works out your core, it works out everything. And these dudes are in this ghetto Galilee fishing boat, and they're trying to row across the sea. And Mark actually tells us that they were rowing against the wind. So that means that they were rowing at night, so it's like midnight, and they're rowing against the storm, so they're not getting very far. So when John records for us that they made it a couple miles, 3 or 4 miles, that probably took them a good couple hours. These guys are exhausted. They're going against the grain. It's kind of like I love watching the birds in Tucson when it's like really windy. And you ever see that bird that's just getting it and he's going nowhere, you know, like he's, it's like super witty and he like rests for 1 second. He gets blown back like 10 feet. You're like, you feel so sorry for him. You're like, man, just walk, you know, you might as well just walk. And the disciples, they're kind of in that spot where they're like, oh my gosh, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, you put yourself in their shoes. They're just getting it on this water. They're barely moving. And then all of a sudden they see, what the heck, what is that? And then, is Jesus, like, whoa, and it actually says they started freaking out, like, they actually started screaming, like, little girls, and they're freaking out about, it's a ghost, and they're freaking out, and Jesus comes, and we know from the Gospel of Matthew that Peter actually said, man, you know, I'll meet you on the water, and you guys all know that story, but I'm not going to get into that, because John doesn't talk about it, but this is kind of what's going on in this moment, and we're going to talk about why that's important, but verse 20 is the major verse that we're going to be focusing on tonight. He said to them, it is I, do not be afraid. Then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going. The other Gospels actually tell us that the storm stopped, and then they were able to row to the other side. But it felt immediately, because, I mean, after you're, you know, struggling against a storm, it feels pretty good to not have a storm, and to make it very quickly. But we're going to focus primarily, like I said, on verse 20, because it is incredibly rich, this statement that he says. Now, we as people reading in our English Bibles, we read the statement by Jesus and we're like, so what? It is I, do not be afraid. That doesn't sound very impressive to me. In the original language, this is what Jesus said. He says, I am, do not be afraid. That's literally what he said. In the Greek, it's ego, eimi. I am. That's what he said. The reason why it's translated that way in your Bibles is because we as English speakers, if it said, I am, do not be afraid, we're like, man, did Jesus stutter? Like, what the heck is he talking about? That sounds freaking weird. You know, like, what is wrong with him? It doesn't really equate to us because we don't really think about this statement. And we're going to spend all the tonight talking about why does Jesus call himself I am? And why is that important? Why is that important for us to know? Now, it should also be noted that what Jesus is doing right here, again, when he's walking on water, like, man, that's pretty cool. You know, Jesus could walk on water. That's pretty neat. I wish I could do that. You have to understand, when Jesus did that, that was very significant. This is the fifth miracle that he's done. That was a very significant thing that he did. Why? Because in Job chapter 9, Job says, only God strides on the water. Does that make sense? It says, God alone strides on the water. So when Jesus is walking on the water, disciples who know the Old Testament, and they see Jesus walking on the water, what's going on in their mind? Only God can do that. And here Jesus is doing it. See, he didn't just do it to show off. He wasn't like, you know what, I got the skill, but you know, when am I going to use that? You know, what would be a cool time to use that? I know. You know, I'm going to tell my disciples to row out in the middle of the sea, and I'm going to walk, and they're going to be like, whoa, and I'm going to be like, yeah, you know, and I'm going to jump in the boat. That's not what he was thinking. He was thinking, I want to show them my dominion over all of creation and my Godhead. And this is how he did it, by walking on water. And then when he approaches them, he says a very significant thing. He says, I am. Now, why is that significant? The reason why it's significant is because God of the Old Testament, who is the God of the New Testament, when he is talking to the ancient peoples, he has to differentiate himself between the other gods and the deities. And the way he chose to do it was he gave himself a name. And that name is Yahweh. I don't know if you guys have ever heard that before, or Jehovah. You guys ever heard those? Yahweh, Jehovah? Yahweh and Jehovah are our best guesses at what God's name was. Because the Hebrews were so sanctified this name that they refused to write vowels in it. So all it had is YHWH. And so we assume that's our best guess. Yahweh is our best guess at what it might have sounded like. Jehovah is the German translation of that. If you ever wondered, that's what it is. And that word, Yahweh, what it meant is it meant I am. So let's go back to the Old Testament. The first time God explains this name to us, this is in Exodus chapter 3, when Moses is speaking to God in the burning bush, and God's about to give him his mission to the Egyptians and to freeing his people. And this is what God says to Moses, because Moses is freaked out. He says, who should I say sent me? You know, because people are going to ask, like, man, who are you? And so in verse 14, God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. So those people who disagree with the deity of Jesus, you have to say that Jesus was absolutely ignorant of the Old Testament, that he was a moron, that he was like walking on water. He's like, oh man, I blew it. You know, it says only God could do that in the Old Testament, and I just did it. Man, people are going to get the wrong idea. And then I said, I am. Man, I was really, that was so stupid. You'd have to say that Jesus is just a moron if you don't believe in the deity of Christ, that he was really, really stupid and he misled people on accident. But for those of us who believe in the deity of Christ, this statement makes perfect sense. Now, why does God call himself the I Am? Why did he choose that name? Of all the names he could have chosen, he could have chosen like Blazer, Laser, something like that. But he chooses Yahweh. You know, he chooses this name that sounds very odd to us. And it means I Am. And that sounds very odd to us as well. And I'm going to give you guys three reasons tonight why God calls himself the Great I Am, why he calls himself Yahweh, and why it's important that we see Jesus as our I Am. Okay? Three reasons. The first reason why he calls himself the I Am is an I Am statement, not saying I am hungry, but saying I am, like God just did, I am. It reveals that your existence is dependent on no one else. Okay? It means your existence is dependent on no one else. Now, I have to point this out. A couple years ago, maybe a year ago, a movie came out called Avengers Age of Ultron, which was awesome, by the way. But in the movie, there was a character in the movie who made an I Am statement. He made an I Am statement, and it offended a lot of Christians. I remember a couple people talked to me about it. A character in the movie, he said, I'm neither a child of Stark, being Iron Man, or a child of Ultron, being the bad guy. I am. And that's what he said. And it offended a lot of Christians. Now, technically that statement should offend us, but not for the reason what people were presenting to me. Because people were saying we should be offended by that because he's claiming to be God. He wasn't claiming to be God. This is what he was claiming. He was making a philosophical statement that many people in our culture make today. The statement is, my consciousness is not dependent on anyone else. I just am. The way that I think, the way that I am, the way that I act, it's not dependent on some God who created me or formed me or knows me or has a plan or purpose for me. I just am. This is in our Bible. This claim has been made by other people. This is in Isaiah chapter 47. This is one of the first times we hear someone making this boastful statement against God. Isaiah 47, verse 10. This is the Babylonian speaking. For you have trusted in your wickedness. So God's speaking to the Babylonians. You have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge have warped you, and you have said in your heart, I am, and there is no one else besides me. Do you see their boast? There is no God. No one sees what I do. There is no judge. There is no final judgment. I can do whatever I want. I am, and there is no one beside me. A lot of people make that statement today, don't they? I am, there's no one beside me. There's no God. I just am. The way that I am is just because of the way that I am. And that's what people are saying when they make that statement. And that's what actually the character in that movie was saying. He's saying, my consciousness isn't dependent on anyone else. I just am. Does that make sense to you guys? Now, if you are an atheist, you can make this statement. And there's nothing blasphemous about it. You're not making a claim to be a god. But if you believe in a god, this is a very blasphemous thing to say. Because what you're saying is you're contradicting what the Bible has stated about us, and that we are created beings by God for a purpose, and our consciousness is completely dependent upon Him. Your whole reason for existence is dependent on God. Now, we don't like to say that in our culture. Why? Because we want to be free. You see, if you're created and you have a purpose, and someone made you for a purpose, that means you're not actually free. That means that someone is controlling you. They have formed you, and they have a plan for you. So you're not free. You're not free to do what you want. The only way for me to actually say I am and there is no one else is for me to embrace a life of meaninglessness. Listen to what a guy named Albert Camus said. We modern people believe in absolute freedom. Many of us don't believe in God at all. Many of us don't believe in God, in a God that we can really know. Therefore, we believe in no God, or no God that we could really know, because we believe in freedom. If there was a God we could know, who told us how we had to live, who gave us the rules and the regulations, well, then we wouldn't be free. But because we believe in freedom and because we don't believe in the traditional view of God, we are free. You notice what he's saying? If your life is created, if you are a created being, and there is a God out there that has a plan and a purpose for you, you're not actually free. And he's actually told us how to live. You're not actually a free agent. You're not actually a free being. Let me give you an example. If I create something, let's say I create, I'm not an inventor, but let's say I am, you know, and I invent something. Let's say it's a cool case for a phone or something like that. Because I've created it, and because I had a purpose behind creating it, that phone case is not free to be whatever it wants. It can only be a phone case, because that's what I created it to do. I could take that phone case and I could say, you know what, this is going to make a great boomerang. In the name of absolute freedom, I'm going to boomerang this bad boy. But it's not going to work, because that's not what it was created for. See, you're going against the design parameters for that object. See, if God has created us, that means that you have a master and a ruler. You're not free. You have to do the things that he has told us to do. Now, a lot of us don't like that. We listen to that. I don't like that. I don't like the idea that God is the I am. I don't like that Jesus is the I am. Why can't I be the I am and make the rules for my life? Why can't I decide what is best for me? And a lot of times, a lot of Christians think this way. And here's what they do. They have selective hearing with God. This is what I did for years, and I probably still do it to this day. When I read the Bible is not an authority over me. I am authority over it. Here's what I mean. For years, I read the Bible, and I read passages like James 5:16. Confess your trespasses to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. And I read that passage, and I said, that doesn't apply to me. That's for other people. You know, I don't need that. I need to confess my trespasses to other people. It's a personal thing. You know, I'm going to go that way. Or I read passages like, say, Matthew chapter 5, where he says, if your right hand causes you sin, cut it off and throw it away from you. For it is better for you to go into heaven whole than into hell maimed. And I read that passage. I was like, that doesn't apply to me either. You know, I know that this, every single time I go on the internet, I view porn. But you know what? I don't think I really need to make any sort of amputation in my life, because it just doesn't apply to me. Okay, or I'd read a passage like Romans 13. I hated Romans 13. I hated it. So Romans 13, you guys don't know what passage that is. Okay, Romans 13 says you must submit to all those in authority. And I was in the Marine Corps and I read that. And I was like, no, you know, the guys that are in authority over me are jerks, you know. And Paul doesn't understand what a big jerk my commander is. You know, he probably had a great boss. You know, he probably just working for Jesus, freelancing. You know, it's probably no big deal for Paul to submit. But for me, it's such a hard thing that can't apply to me. But then I started thinking about it logically, and I started thinking, okay, well, the government over Paul was the Romans. It's not the best governing body to submit to. And Paul is saying we need to submit to these guys. It was a crazy passage. It convicts me. But do you see my point? Those are just a couple. I could probably pull out many, many more that I struggled with. But when I read a passage like that, I was like, oh, I don't like it. Or how about this one? Let no profane speech proceed from your mouth. I hated that one because I loved cussing. I was like, man, dude, it's like SpongeBob SquarePants. There's a part where they learn swear words, and Patrick is trying to convince SpongeBob. He's like, no, it's not a bad word. It's a sentence enhancer. He said, you just sprinkle it all over whatever sentence you're speaking, and bam, you have a spicy sandwich sentence. You know, and I would listen to that, I'd be like, yeah, that sounds right on, you know? Because, you know, nothing really expresses rage like the F word, you know? It's just so much better than crap or darn, you know? Like, it just flows out, and it feels so natural and nice. So I didn't like that passage. I was like, man, why is it in there? You know, that can't apply to me. See, there are so many passages that I could point out right now that you or me have looked at and said, I'm not really in submission to that. You see, when you do that, you're not treating Jesus like he is the I am. You're not treating Jesus as your Lord, your master and savior. The one in whom Paul quotes in Acts chapter 17, he says, that we live and we move and we have our being. This one who has created me, who has formed me, who has a plan and a purpose for my life, who has shaped me and made me everything that I am today, and has a perfect knowledge of what I'm going to be tomorrow. This one who has entered into my life and called himself my king has given me a commandment, and I'm saying, I don't feel it. Here's another good example. I don't know if you guys remember when we had construction on this highway. This is a couple years ago. I don't know if you guys had your driver's license yet. But on this highway, there was a really annoying thing that happened. There was this weird stretch of highway that the speed limit was 45 miles an hour. And it made no sense. And it was a straightaway. There was no construction happening on it or anything like that. But it just, for no reason, it dropped to 45 miles an hour. And it would be so funny because I'd be driving next to people, and I usually go about, 4 to 5 miles over the speed limit. I've got enough speed tickets in my life to know not to go over that. But, I'll usually go about 4 or 5 miles over the speed limit. And I would be passing people when the speed limit's 65. But all of a sudden, when I got to the speed limit being 45, everybody was passing me. And I was like, what the heck? Everybody continued to go 60 miles an hour like there was no speed limit sign. You know what that proved to me? People don't follow the speed limit sign because they are in submission to the government. They follow the speed limit sign when they agree with it. You see, when they're driving down the road and they're like, hey, 65 makes sense to me. I'll follow that. But when they're driving down the road and it sits to 45, like, that makes no sense. I'm not going to follow it. That's for people who suck at driving. I've been driving for years. I'm not going to crash. That's ridiculous. And they just keep going the speed that they're going. Does that make sense to you guys? When you do that, you're not submitting. You don't have a submissive heart. One of the most convicting books that I ever read, it was after I got out of the Marine Corps. I read a book called The Exemplary Husband. Great book if you want to just be raked over the coals about everything bad that you're doing in your life for single or married people. And there's a section in that book that says, are you a proud person? And I never really saw myself as a proud person, which should have been my first clue that I am a proud person. But I never really saw myself as a proud person. I started reading that chapter. And one of the sections, I'll never forget, it said, if you refuse to submit to authority that you don't like, you are a proud person. And I realized that is exactly how I am. See, when my teacher gave me an assignment that I didn't like, I would probably write a whole paper about why that assignment was stupid and hand it in. When someone gave me an assignment that I didn't really think was important in the Marine Corps, I would usually figure out the most creative way to ruin that person's day by doing that assignment wrong. Like, for instance, there were times where my commander would ask me to dig a hole in a certain position. I'd be like, I'm going to dig a hole in the place where I know it's going to piss him off the most, like right in front of his tent. I'm going to dig a 6-foot hole right in front. It took me hours to do this. But I just did it because I was just so belligerent in my heart. I was just like, I'm not going to submit. No one's going to break me. I once got a speeding ticket for smiling. All right? Why? No one else would have gotten the speeding ticket. But the reason why I got the speeding ticket, because I'm just so belligerent. I could have let it go at any point in time. But I smiled at the guy because I knew it would piss him off. And then I kept it going. And I kept it going until he finally gave me a ticket. You see, I'm just such a belligerent person. I don't like submitting. I don't like people being an authority over me. I don't like it. Does that make sense? So when Jesus says, I am, do not be afraid, that sentence makes no sense to me because my flesh says, I don't like the fact that you're the I am. I don't like that. I don't like that you're an authority over everything. I like some of the things that you say, Jesus, but I may not like all the things that you say. So I will follow your commandments as so long as they don't interfere with what I believe. This is a quote from Aldous Huxley. He had much the same thought pattern as me. Aldous Huxley, very famous writer. He wrote Brave New World, which is an amazing book. But anyway, atheist, says this. I had motives for wanting the world to have a meaning, or to not have a meaning, and consequently assumed that it had none. It was able, without difficulty, any difficulty, to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. So he's carrying off Albert Camus' purpose. Because Albert Camus' point was the only way you could be absolutely free is to declare that there is no God. And if there is no God, there is no meaning. There is no meaning. So here Aldous Huxley is saying this. There is no meaning. I came to the conclusion that there is no meaning for existence. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not really concerned exclusively with the problem in pure philosophy. He is also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants. For myself, as no doubt for most of my friends, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. The supporters of this system claimed that it embodied the meaning, the Christian meaning, they insisted of the world. There was one admirably simple method of confuting these people and justifying ourselves in our erotic revolt. We would deny that the world had any meaning whatsoever. So what was Aldous Huxley's motivation to become an atheist? Sex. If I believe there's a God, I have to believe there's a purpose and design for my sexuality, and then I have to restrict myself. I would rather believe there is no God than to believe there is a God. Does that make sense? Here's what's going to happen to us if we have this type of mentality. So those of you who are like me, who are proud, who don't like the fact that Jesus is the I am, this is how you can know that you're like me. If you consistently doubt the existence of God for no logical, scientific, or historical reason, you're like me. Why do I doubt the existence of God? Because I don't like the way that God operates. He doesn't operate the way that I want him to. He doesn't do the things that I think he should. He doesn't say the things that I want him to say. And so instead of just saying, you know what, you're God, I'm not, I'm going to submit to you, I say, there is no God. Does that make sense? It is a tool of my liberation. See, the reason why you doubt God all the time is not because any new information has been given to you. It's not because you sat through a lecture by Richard Dawkins and you're like, this makes a lot of sense. That's not why you're doubting God. You're doubting God because he doesn't conform to what you think God should be. Does that make sense? You are not under God's authority. God is under your authority. I will love you and I will respect you as so long as you conform to my mold of who I think you should be. As we continue John chapter 6, we're going to see a whole group of people that do this to Jesus. They try to conform him to a mold. They try to say, you're the king. You're the king. You're going to liberate us from the Romans. And he keeps telling them, no, I'm not. And they leave him. They leave him because of it. You see, understanding that Jesus is the I am means that you have to understand your submission towards him, your need to submit to what he does. But here's the beautiful thing. Submission to God is the most liberating and value-giving thing that you and I can ever do. In fact, it gives you the most infinite value that you can ever have. Okay, because here's the thing. You have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. If you say there's no God, you have to say that your life has absolutely no meaning. You have to. You can't have it both ways. You can't say there is no God, yet my life has an infinite meaning. Why? Because God is the one who gives your life a meaning. God is the one who gives your life a meaning. If there is no God, one day you're going to die. And one day, very soon, everyone is going to forget about you. Just think about that for a second. In about 100 years, me, no one will remember I even existed. I will be some weird photo on a wall in someone's house. When my great-great-great-grandson says, hey, that's my great-great-grandpa P something. All right, let's go on to the other. That's all I'm going to be in 100 years. That's it. If I agree that there is no God and there is no eternity, I have to accept that my life is without meaning, value, or purpose. You have to. There's no other way. At least Camus and Huxley are honest about it. There are a lot of atheists who are not honest about it, and they say, no, my life has meaning. You just took away the ground for your meaning. As C.S. Lewis put it, you just sawed off the branch that you were standing on. You can't have it both ways. You cannot believe that there is no God and yet believe you have infinite meaning. You can't do it. The only way that you could believe you can have any meaning is if a God exists and there is an eternity. And here's the beautiful thing. Value, the easiest way for me to understand value is what someone's willing to pay for something. That's the easiest way for me in my mind to understand value. For instance, the housing market was such a devastating thing because people who thought that they owned $400,000 homes were only receiving $200,000 for them. It was a devastating blow to people. Why? The value of their home went down. It doesn't matter what they thought their home was worth. It only mattered what people were willing to pay for it. Does that make sense to you guys? That is what determined its value. If there is a God and you do have a price, the only way for me to determine your value and my value is to see how much was someone willing to pay for me. Does that make sense? The price that God was willing to pay for you was his only begotten son. What does that do to your value? See, what does that do to your value? It increases it exponentially. It brings it beyond anything that you could ever have of saying there is no reason, there is no value, there is no meaning, there is no purpose. See, it gives you infinite meaning. gives you infinite value if you believe that there is a God and He is the great I Am. But only if you believe these things specifically about Jesus. And here's another beautiful thing. Your value and your meaning and your identity are distinct from what you do. Because when was Jesus willing to pay the price for you? Was it when you, hey man, you guys fix yourself up? Maybe I'll pay the price. It says in Romans 5, God demonstrates His love for us that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. You see, it gives you infinite value if you understand the reason for God being the great I Am. But it only works if you submit to Him. See, it only works if you submit to Him fully. If you don't submit to Him fully, then these words that I'm saying to you right now, they're not going to mean anything to you. Because in the back recesses of your mind, you still kind of doubt the existence of God anyway. It's just rhetoric. See, the only way it works is if you agree there is a God and I'm going to start acting like there's a God. I'm going to start acting like there was a design to my life. And I'm going to start doing what that design says. I'm not going to go against it anymore. I'm going to do exactly what He said that I was designed to do, and I'm going to conform to His image, not make Him conform to mine. Does that make sense? Seeing God as that version of the I Am. Now, there's another way to understand Him being the I Am, and that is that God is timeless. God is timeless. Oh, I forgot to mention. In that other version of God, when I said that He's the I Am, meaning He's self-existent, that is what distanced Him from every other God. Every other God before this, other religions have copied this, like Islam, Mormonism. I mean, not Mormonism, actually. Islam and Jehovah's Witness have copied this. But before this time, every God wasn't eternal. They weren't self-explanatory. They all needed an explanation. They all needed something outside of themselves to create themselves. They weren't everything. They weren't the source of all life. In fact, you read Greek mythology, and the universe has always existed in Greek mythology. In fact, we all come from the result of the sky, Uranus, and the earth, Gaia, having sex and procreating. That's where everyone comes from. See, in every single mythology religion that you could name, the gods are not eternal, and they are not the source of all life and meaning. They're just kind of there. They're actually participators with us in life and purpose and meaning. And the Eastern religions still hold to that, by the way. So this idea of God being the I Am is unique throughout all history. This is another way it's unique. It puts Him outside of time. Let me go to another passage. This is John 8. We're going to get to it in a little bit, but this is John 8, verse 58. This is what Jesus said. So I can't wait till we get to this discussion because it's awesome. This is a great example of Jesus like pushing people over the line. You know, He's just like, He's making statements that are just like alienating people, and people are like, I don't know about that. And He just goes to the top of what's the most offensive thing I could say, and He says it. And they're questioning Him because He just said, you know, your father Abraham, he saw my day and he was glad. He rejoiced. They said, man, you're not even 50 years old. How can you know Abraham? And this is what He says. John 8, 58. Jesus said to them, most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. This is what He's saying. He's saying, I'm timeless. If all He wanted to say is, I've existed for a long time, or even, I have had a pre-eternal existence, that's still not, that sentence doesn't make any sense. He should have said, before Abraham was, I was. Does that make sense? But to say, before Abraham was, I am, what it's stating is that He exists outside of time. Now, this is hard for us to understand. God exists outside of time. In fact, God created time. Isn't that crazy? That time had a beginning. There was a time where there was no time. It was the land before time, not the movie. But it was the land before time. There was no time. There was no source or anything like that. God created time at a moment. He created time at a moment. And that means, and the best way that I've ever understood this is God relates to this world the same way that an author relates to a book. Okay, or that you relate to a movie. If I go home tonight and I pop in a movie, like the Peanuts movie or something like that, one of my favorites, and I start watching the movie, okay, for those characters in the movie, they are on a linear timeline. Does that make sense? They have a beginning, they have a middle, they have an end, they have a plot, they have character dynamic, they have things that happen to them throughout the movie. But at any point in time, I could pause the movie, and I could walk away, and I could go do something. See, for me, time is still going, but for them, time has stood still. See, I activate the time. And at any point in time, I could rewind. I go back to another point in the movie. See, for the characters, things are still happening linearly. But for me, everything is happening at once. The movie has become relative to me. I could jump to any scene in the movie that I want to. You see, to the movie, I am. The movie has a timeline, I do not, in relation to the movie. Does that make sense to you guys? That's how God relates to this universe. So you can't think of God as being a linear person. He's not someone who, you know, he's watching things unfold. He is beyond it. He is above time. He's beyond time. Chuck Smith put it this way. He says, I can never make an I am statement like this. Because if I say I am, well, I guess actually I was because I said it a couple seconds ago. God always is. He never was. Jesus always is I am. There is no such thing as past, present, or future for him. He is always there. He always just exists. Now, what does that mean for us as Christians? This is cool. I'm only going to mention one verse. I would like to mention all of them, but I'm only going to mention a couple verses from Psalm 139. Psalm 139 is a psalmist reasoning through this perspective of God being timeless and talking about the benefits of it. And it's really cool. It's really beautiful to read through it. But here's the major thing that we pull away from it. A lot of times, if you're like me, you struggle with the thought of, does God really hear me? Does God really hear me? Does he really understand the things that are happening in my life? Is he really there? See, because we think about God as a being who is consumed by time, like we are. So when we're praying, we're like, did he even really hear that? You know, maybe there's so many prayers going up to him right now that he's like, oh man, you know, like Bruce Almighty, you know, he's like trying to filter them through and trying to get to the right ones, you know. Does he really even hear me? Maybe he's got angels listening in or something like that, like, hey God, you know, this is an important one, and then the other ones, you just file that away, you know, that's not a really important prayer. Yeah, is that really how it is? You tend to feel that way sometimes. Now, this is really, really cool. If God is, first of all, eternal, and secondly, relates to this world the way an author relates to a book, that means that he is infinitely and eternally invested in every moment of your life. Here's what I mean. Let's say tonight I get stomach sickness, which happens to me often. I get a stomach sickness, and I've got cramps, and I'm sitting in my bed, and I'm like, God, help me. Here's the cool thing about God. Think about an author, if he was writing that in a story, and then Peter cried out, God, help me. For me as the character in that story, time continues to go on, but for God, he can spend all of eternity thinking about that moment. That moment has never passed for him. He has all of eternity to meditate and to think and to ponder about that one sentence. That moment never passes for him. It continuously happens for him, always. Isn't that a weird way to think about it? So that means that if something bad happens to me, it happened to me in the past, but for God, it's always happening for him. It's happening at all times. He's eternal. Does that make sense? He's eternal. He can see it at all times. So you should never ever fear of, man, did God even hear my prayer? Or is he even interested? God is always invested. You see, he's eternally invested in every single prayer that you've ever prayed. He has thought for eternity over every moment that has happened inside of your life. The psalmist in 139, he put it this way. He says, if I were to number the thoughts that you have towards me, it would be more than the sands of the seashore. He says, they're infinite. You can't even number them because you're eternal. You're not constrained by time. You're not constrained by anything that I can think of. You think about me all the time. God always thinks about you. Even the things that you have forgotten about in your life, God is in that moment. He remembers it. Now, this perspective of God also has a negative thing, because I got to think about this. For a timeless being to engage in death, to experience death. See, for us, the cross happened 2,000 years ago. But when did it happen for God? It's always happening. Isn't that radical to think about? Just to think about that. That for God, the cross has always been happening, and it always will be happening. He is forever dead. Does that make sense? Could you imagine the sacrifice that God had to go through to do that? In fact, the Bible, it describes Jesus as the lamb slain before the foundations of the earth. Isn't that crazy? Before God said, let there be light, he already experienced death. Because for him, he is. He is the I am. That for me, when I started to wrap my mind around that, that made the sacrifice of the cross so much more beautiful for me. Because it was one thing to think about, yeah, Jesus did something at one time for me. And it was like a couple hours long, and that's serious, whatever. But for me to understand that, no, Jesus suffered eternally. And it also didn't make sense for me because I thought about it like this. If the punishment for sin is eternity in hell, how is it right that God pays off that debt with a finite amount of time on the cross? Does that make sense to you guys? Like, that doesn't really equate. If I was supposed to spend eternity in hell and God only has to spend 2 hours on the cross, that's not really a good transaction. That's not right. But when I started understanding the eternality of God, I started to see, no. God did suffer and die for all of eternity. He is, in a way, suffering and dying for all of eternity. Isn't that a crazy sacrifice that he did for us? It's amazing. And a God who is willing to do that for me, how can I not believe that he is not infinitely invested in everything that's going on in my life? Even the things that don't seem like a big deal to me. It says that your very hairs on your head are numbered and known in heaven. That's crazy to me. So, dude, I don't even care about how many hairs are on my head, but God does. He's infinitely invested in the most mundane issues of your life. And if he cares that much about that fact, how much more does he care about the important things that are happening in your life? See, understanding Jesus as the I Am gives us rest. This is what the writer of Hebrews says. This is Hebrews chapter 7, speaking of Jesus' ministry. And this is something that the writer of Hebrews also had a hard time wrapping his mind around, but he expresses it this way. Hebrews 7, verse 23, also, there are many priests because they were prevented by death from continuing. But he, Jesus, because he continues forever, has an unchangeable priesthood. Notice that word. It doesn't change. It's the same. It's eternal. Therefore, he is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Jesus is standing before the Father, talking to the Father about you for eternity. There's no end to it. He is always talking about you. There's no moment where he's not talking about you. There's no moment where he's not thinking about you. He is always thinking about you. Isn't that crazy? And because he's eternal, he's able to give that level of care and attention and devotion to every single one of us. He's not limited. He's not limited. He doesn't have to give a proxy to someone's case. He could take every single one of our cases individually and perfectly. Isn't that cool? And the writer of Hebrews is thinking about that. He's meditating on it. He's like, man, it's beautiful. And the greatest promise that he gives, he could have given so many, but this is the greatest promise he gives. He is able to save to the uttermost those who come to God. Now, I'm just going to point this out very quickly because it is so beautiful. He doesn't say, prepositions are important, kids. He does not say he's able to save from the uttermost those who come to God. That would be enough. That would be cool. That no matter where you are in life, no matter how jacked up you are and how much of a sinner you are, you can come to God and he's able to save you because he can save from the uttermost. That's true. But that's not what this passage is saying. He says he's able to save to the uttermost. You know what that means? He's able to take anyone and make them perfect. Because he's eternal. See, so much of the discouragement that I experienced in my life, of struggling with pornography, of struggling with pride, of struggling with anger, of struggling with fear, anxiety, worry, all these things, you see, they come from me not understanding the eternality of God. I feel like I've let God down. He can't work through me. He can't do this. You see, for him, he's been meditating on your case for all of eternity. He knows where you're going, and he is able to save you to the uttermost. He will save you to the uttermost. He will make you in his image. Me and Emma, we love watching HGTV. And there's a show on it called Fixer Upper. I love it. It's one of my favorite shows. And in the show, what they do is they have a couple, and they'll find a house that, I mean, well they want to buy a house, but they have a budget. And so what they do is they'll find a crappy house. And these two people will renovate it and make it like a really nice, like $500,000 home in a budget. It's really awesome to watch it. And the episodes that I like watching the most are the ones where the house is most run down. See, if the house is already pretty cool, it's like, okay, the transformation is not going to be that cool. All right, I'll flip the channel. But if the house is like, man, there's like pee stains all over the floor, and there's cement in the toilets, and there's rats going everywhere, and there's cockroaches crawling, I'm like, yeah, this is going to be good. You know, because like the transformation is going to be amazing. You see? the bigger the disaster, the greater the glory of the builder. When you see yourself as a mess, you understand that's the greatest opportunity for God to reveal His glory in you. Does that make sense? Seeing yourself as a mess is not looking at God and saying, you can never work with me. Seeing yourself as a mess is a great opportunity for you to say, I can't wait to see what you're going to do with me. I can't wait to see what you have planned for all of eternity to do in my life. You are going to save me to the uttermost. You're going to bring me to the place where you wanted me to be. You're going to make me just like your son. You know how to do it, and you're going to do it. See, it's a great opportunity for us as Christians to calm down. Remember the story that we're reading. The disciples are rowing against the current. They're not making any progress. And Jesus comes to them and He says, I am. Don't be afraid. So often in my Christian life, don't you feel like that sometimes? Where you're rowing against the current? You're like, man, I don't feel like I'm making any progress. And you know what Jesus says to you? Don't be afraid. Why? Because He is. He says, because I am. That's why you shouldn't be afraid. He's able to save you to the uttermost. He's able to bring you to the other side. Notice what happens immediately after He comes into the boat. And immediately the boat was at the land where they were going. See, with God, time is not linear like us. For them, it was like an instant. Right at the shore, right where they were going. See, don't feel discouraged because it's taking a long time. Because God is working out His plan in you. And the third and final reason why God is the I Am, why He calls Himself the I Am. I don't have a lot of time to go into this. I would love to spend like an entire sermon talking about this. But the word Yahweh also means the becoming one. It means the becoming one. It means that Jesus, God, becomes to us everything that we need. I love the psalm that we just sang where the lyrics were, when He brings me through the desert, He does it so that He could be my water. When I go through the night, He does it so He could be my morning. Does that make sense? God wants to be your everything. He wants to be your everything. He is the becoming one. If you need a healer, He wants to be your healer. If you want love, He wants to be your lover. If you want a friend, He wants to be your friend. If you want a king, He wants to be your king. He wants to be everything that you need in your life and more. And like I said, in this book, we haven't gotten to any of them yet. We're about to get to the first one next week. Jesus makes 7 I Am statements to show that He is the becoming one. These are the statements that He makes. I am the bread of life. John 6, verse 35. I am the light of the world. John 8, verse 12. I am the gate. John 10, verse 9. I am the good shepherd. John 10, verse 11. I am the resurrection and the life. John 11, verse 25 to 26. I am the way, the truth and the life. John 14, verse 6. And I am the vine. John 15, verse 5. And we'll talk much more in detail about what each one of those mean. But let me just take a couple of them. The bread of life. He says, I am the bread of life. He becomes to me my soul's greatest satisfaction, sustenance, and portion. He's all I need. See, I don't need the things of this world anymore. I don't need the pleasures of this world anymore because Jesus has become my pleasure and my joy. See, He says, I am the light of the world. He is the thing that I see by. I see all truth and all things by Him. He reveals things to me. I'm not lost anymore. God shows me His plan and His purposes. He leads me in a way that I need to be led. He is the gate, meaning He is my ultimate access to God. In fact, do you know that Jesus' name comes from a conjunction? Yah being short for Yahweh, and Shua being short for salvation. Jesus' name literally is, God has become my salvation. That's what His name means. The only way I can make it to God, the only way that Jesus could be my gate, the only way to get to Him, the door, is through the Son. Jesus has made a way for me to be with God forever. I am the good shepherd. Jesus leads me. He guides me. He protects me. He disciplines me. He builds me up. He shows me the right way. I am the resurrection and life. He is my hope for a better life after this one. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. There's a beautiful thing in knowing that He is truth. I like thinking about that a lot, that Jesus is truth. He doesn't just tell us truth. He is truth. He embodies it. And He is the way to God, and He is the life that we will have for all of eternity. I am the vine, and you are the branches. Those who abide in me will bear much fruit. He is the means to which you will have spiritual growth and freedom and prosperity by abiding in Him. He gives you your nourishment. He gives you your satisfaction. Everything comes from Him. He is the source from all life. You see, Jesus becomes everything to the Christian who lets Jesus be everything to us. See, for a long time, even as a Christian, Jesus was never my pleasure. I found my pleasure in earthly things. But then over time, he started to reveal himself to me. I started reading Psalm 16, verse 11. You will show me the path of life, because in your presence is the fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. And I started thinking, am I treating Jesus like my pleasure? Like he's my joy, my satisfaction. I started reading Psalm 73, verse 25. Whom have I in heaven but you, and upon the earth there is none that I desire but you. My heart and my flesh fail, but you are the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Is God your treasure? Has he become your treasure? Or are you still trying to find treasure in relationships, in jobs, in things, in success? Has Jesus become your treasure? See, you can be a Christian for a long time and not see Jesus as your everything. Not see him as the I am, the becoming one. See, another beautiful one to me, I like this one. This is Psalm chapter 3. The psalmist says, he is the lifter of my head. He is the lifter of my head. Now think about that. To lift your head up, what does that mean? You know, if I saw one of you like looking all down, I'd be like, hey man, pick your head up. What am I saying? And be encouraged, right? Be lifted up. Be proud. Be honored. Be glorified. Here's what the psalmist is saying. Jesus is the one who does that for me. He shows me I have value. He shows me that I have honor. He shows me that he's proud of me. You see? He's the lifter of my head. I love, and I encourage you guys, go through the Psalms. Just go through the Psalms, raffle through them, and find all the places where a psalmist says, God, you are my blank. You are my strength. You are my shield. You are my song. You are my fortress. You are my strong tower. You are my sword. You are my comfort. There are so many statements I could give. He is the becoming one, you see. There is nothing on this earth that you need that he cannot become for you. He is everything. See, Jesus is the I am. And as we go about in our lives, as we go through every circumstance, whether it is rain or whether it is sunshine, God is trying to show you that he is the I am. This is one of the most important truths that you and I can wrap our minds around. It's something that you will be consistently learning for the rest of your life. And as you learn it and as it sinks into your heart and to the level you allow it to change and impact you, it will do amazing things in your life. You see? But you need to let it. You need to start thinking that way. And it's a process. I don't understand it all, for sure. There are areas where I do not understand that Jesus is the I am. See, sometimes I get angry at my wife, at traffic, at people in the church, at things that are happening inside of my life. And you see, what that reveals is Jesus is not the resurrection and life to me. He hasn't shown me that all sin and things have been punished. He hasn't taken away my anger. He isn't my refuge in that moment. Does that make sense? I don't see him as the great I am in that moment. And I need to see him that way. I need to start praying, God, help me to see you that way. That I would relent, that I would give up this anger, that I would give up this lust, that I would give up this pride, that I would see you as the fulfillment of all these things. See, I want to see Jesus as the I am. That's what I'm always trying to get to. And if I do that, I won't be afraid. It will take away my fear. All right, let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word, that you are the I am, that you are the becoming one. Help us to see you that way more and more each and every day, to delight in you, to love you, to care for you. God, we are so thankful for you. In your name, amen.